What is happening, everybody? It's Jacob Daniel here. This is the Daniel 3 podcast. It's episode something. I didn't even have time to check and see. I don't know. I'll look here. Let's see. Your channel. We are on episode 80. We're on episode 80. Nice. Big 80. It has been crazy. I have been... No, I haven't been purposely taking a break from podcasting. It just for like the last 2 weeks, I was busy with a... baby stuff because my wife had a baby back on May 20th, and then no Ben, I'm not going to sleep. Okay, you are not my ruler. I've been doing a lot of different appearances on different podcasts. So I was on the Enemy of My Enemy podcast a couple weeks ago, and then I was on the Lions of Liberty podcast last week, and I'm missing a couple in between there. I don't know, but I've just been doing a lot of stuff, and I don't know. I miss you guys. I want to talk to you guys, and there's been like no end of Twitter controversies and banter going on that I've been wanting to dive into. So this is kind of a last minute put together live stream, and I got someone returning to the show, although it's their first time joining solo. It's Mr. Anarcho-Catholic or Einkath for short. I appreciate the desire to remain anonymous, but you should just do what I did, which is just make it so no one even knows what your name is, and that way it's even more effective, because once someone doxes you, it's all over. But with me, it's just like, I don't know, is his name Jacob, Daniel, or
which one,
Joshua?
Is it?
What is...
I felt so bad when you were in our chat last night. Oscar Timon was doing a stream, and I just instinctually I started calling you Daniel, like I've been doing like since the very beginning, and I felt guilty about it at some point. But just yeah, everyone sort of got confused what your actual name is.
Yeah, no, but and even
to be here. Thank you for having me for the big 80.
Yeah, no, it's because I feel like I should have more episodes than that. I don't know how Caleb. I feel like Caleb is just like, you know, nonstop. I mean, he's young and single, right? So like, that's all he has time to do. He's like plays video games, puts out like 5 podcasts a day. I mean, like I started before him, but he's already at like 100 something. So
he's got that hustle, man. And just like, you know, he'll read a book and like, okay, I read something. Somebody needs to talk to me about it. Gotta respect
yeah. God, I wish I had time. I read about 5 books a week, but I don't finish them. I get about, you know, 5. And the problem with me is that, like, I have a lot of books I'm reading, but I have so little time to read. And half the time I'm reading, I'm so tired, or it's just there's so much going on around me. I'll read 5 pages. And then the next time I go sit down to read, I'll go, wait, I don't even remember the last 5 pages I read. So I have to reread those 5 pages. And then it's like I'm reading the same 5 pages over and over again and retaining nothing because I'm not in the right frame of mind or setting to actually read. And I want to listen. Like I listen to a lot of podcasts. I've tried getting into audiobooks, but for some reason they just bore me, because like it's easy to listen to people talking in like a conversational fashion like we are now, but to just listen to someone like reading something at you is just, I don't know, my ADHD riddled brain just doesn't process it right.
I'm the exact same way. I can't get into audiobooks, and I think Oscar Timon has been better for me in terms of my reading than anything else in the last, like, since my kids were born. Like I've read more books in the last 6 months just because I had to get ready for podcasts than anything else. But what was I going through today? We're reading something that we're doing a live reading for. And I think I read the same page of Jacques Maritain like 5 times in a row. Cause like I'd start something, baby would start crying, start something, get spit up. Like it was just, and it's a dense enough book that like you have to sort of focus on it. And it was going so slowly that I was like, okay, I actually need to reread this later. Cause I'm not getting it. Even though it's my 4th time going through it.
That's funny.
It is. Ugh.
Yeah,
I enjoy the reading, but I barely find the time. And that's in addition to like the 7 tabs that I've got open of like, oh yeah, I need to get through this. There's this article, this book from Mises.org. Like it's never ending. I wish I had just 6 hours more a day just to read.
Yeah, seriously. No, I wish we had, you know, like I want to go back like God, like 7 days. Okay. Like I mean, who am I to question your creation? But like, you know, we couldn't have eight days, you know, seven and a half. Like, you know, it's just not enough time in the week. You know, I need like an extra, you know, even just 6 hours. Find me an extra 6 hours a week. Oh, my gosh. That would be amazing. But so we've had a lot of since you've been on, there's been a lot that just happened in general. But we've kind of been at times on the same side and at times on the opposite sides of infamous Twitter wars over the last few weeks. Right. So I thought it'd be fun to maybe dive into those topics a little bit and just get some more meat on the conversation, because like with Twitter, it's like, you know, you end up just repeating yourself over and over again, because it's like, well, how many different ways can I say the same thing in 240 characters? Because it's pretty limiting and kind of hard to have a good conversation other than that. One of the things, which it's funny. So I started this podcast because I wanted to convince like mainstream Christianity, and you know, and I included, you know, Catholics in that. I've always tried, even though I'm not a Catholic myself, I've always tried to be more of a big tent. Like, I want to speak to, you know, generally everyone who considers themselves a Christian and try to represent them to the best of my ability. So I've tried to reach people with the idea of the compatibility between Christianity and like anarchist, anarcho-capitalist political theory in Austrian economics. And it's weird because lately I feel like I'm doing the same thing that I set out to do, but I'm doing it with people who like aren't people that I typically thought I would have to do it with. Like people who at one point seemingly were convinced of that and then have now gone in different weird esoteric directions, some of which I can appreciate. Like I've had a lot of conversations with Andrew from Popular Liberty on, and he has some interesting ideas and has kind of gone a slightly different way towards what he called like a private law society, or like a private statecraft direction, which is interesting. Some of it I find fascinating, and even sometimes find myself agreeing to. But then other times that I'm talking to these people and I'm just like, I don't know where things went off the tracks, as far as like these people at one point did see a consistency between these two things and now they don't. So I mean, what's your observation, you know, as far as just in general, the compatibility between Christianity and anarchist political theory? And then we can kind of go more into the different critiques that people from various factions seem to have with that.
Sure. And yeah, I have to sort of echo the same sentiment as I've, you know, sort of hopped into the space and be like, okay, yeah, you know, I've read some Rothbard, read some Hoppe, read some von Mises, and want to sort of, you know, dig into this more and try and get that message out there from a more Christian or Catholic perspective. And then finding all these people who have read more than me in those same spheres and have been doing this longer and who have sort of had their post-libertarian moment, I think, as Andrew would probably say. And it's been interesting for me to watch, because I think I'm still sort of lagging behind them as well in terms of saying, like, you know, okay, like there's something to what I originally thought. It's interesting. I know one of the big things that has been part of the debate recently has been this sort of semantic argument about what is anarchism and what is anarchy and what isn't. And right. Being a very clear, and you know, I'm happy to be a stickler for the definition. But if you're and in that perspective, it's like, okay, yes, there's things about what I believe that is certainly not anarchy in that pure original, you know, translated from the Greek sense. Yeah. But at the same time, like if you're going to look at the Christian anarchist writers that were calling themselves Christian anarchists, like, you know, go back to Tolstoy in the 19th century, or even the sort of anarcho-capitalist tradition. Okay, they were calling themselves anarchists, but they weren't, like, you know, okay, if they chose the wrong term, okay, sorry, I guess they should have used a different word. But I'm sticking. Like, it's such a good reference to, yeah, it's like this.
Right.
This is the theory. Yeah. I don't want to have to spend 30 words trying to describe it if someone's already had a term, even if it's probably not the
and
most.
And that's always been my thing, which is like, I'm not married to the word, but like language is to some extent, like, you know, subjective and words are tools, right? So it's like, you know, I like you said eloquently, I don't want to have to, every time I get into a political conversation, have to write, you know, a paragraph like a leftist to explain what my my political views are. So, you know, it's just like, how can you convey the most information with the least amount of effort possible? And it's like, to me, to say I'm a Christian anarcho-capitalist is as precise as one can be, and putting things in, I think, in a the proper order too, because I to me, like, Christian first, anarchist second, and capitalist last. Not that I think capitalism is unimportant, but it's like I'm mostly tied to Christianity, to my relationship with Christ as my savior, and to the truth found in the Holy Scriptures and taught by the Christian church. And then after that, I believe that, you know, consequentially, I have opinions about, like, political rulers and kingdoms of man and who we should give worship to. And then lastly, it's like I have strong opinions about economics, but it's like, but, like, you know, the economics is, I'm pretty confident about that. But if there was any of those three that I would have to put, like, in a hierarchical structure, what's most and least important, like, the capitalist part kind of has to be at the bottom, just because I think the Christian part has to be at the top, and the anarchy part is, like, if we got to theoretical anarchist land and the state's gone, and it turns out, like, oh, our economic organization is closer to something like mutualism than capitalism, you know, it's not like I'm gonna die mad, you know what I mean? Like, I'd just be like, okay, I guess I was a little bit wrong on some of the economic stuff, but it's like, I could get past that. I couldn't get past, wouldn't, I'd have a much harder time getting past the first two things. We lived in,
yeah, and it's an issue for me. It's about praxis. Like, I'm sort of the, and I think you've got the exact right order there. Like, you know, the most important thing is your relationship with God. Then is your relationship with other men. You know, how do you be moral? How do you do the right thing? And then the economics is sort of the praxis of it. It's like, okay, what's the given what we know is the right thing to do, how do we go about doing it?
Right.
Which is important, but those other things have to come first. Is you have to have this understanding of the supernatural and the metaphysical and the divine, and then you can kind of get, okay, based on that, how should I act to other men? And then based on that, okay, what's the best way to sort of achieve these moral goals? And so that's also probably the order of certainty with me too. It's like, I think I sort of have the best grasp on my faith and what that should mean for me. And then the next is, okay, what political system sort of, you know, can uphold that moral standard? Well, you know, there might be different options. You know, you could convince me, okay, yeah, it turns out some kind of, you know, anarcho-feudalism, Yarvinian post, like, okay, that sure, I guess, possibly. Like, is it, I mean, my question is always, is it moral?
Yeah, that's my thing. Although I'll grant, like, if I had my choice between the status quo and the ideas that the post-libertarians are pushing out, it's like, well, I find what they're pushing to be a lot more appealing than the status quo. But yeah, I still don't know if that's sort of my, you know, both. I think you put it well. It's like, it's sort of like, what, because there's a moral component and a praxis component, right? And it's like, I consider myself politically anarchist in a sense of, like, what I think is moral, based upon both like philosophical reason and also Christian norms for what the relationships should be, man to fellow man. And that said, it's like, okay, so, like, that's the ideal. Can we reach that? I don't know. Like, I'm kind of agnostic in terms of, like, can we reach in this reality, in this earth, in this age, can we reach a society that is living out a, you know, anarchistic social praxis, right? And if and then if that's possible, how widespread is it, how long does it last? Like, those are things I don't know, and I just kind of hope for the best. I guess I'm somewhat of a political realist, which is, like, if what I have to settle for is some sort of minarchy or feudal, you know, decentralized monarchy, it's like, okay, I wouldn't be 100% content with those, but again, like, compared to what? Like, compared to the global corporate wokeism,
fascist, whatever, yeah, death cult, yes,
yeah.
Well, and even beyond that, because I've heard the argument occasionally, like, you know, like, you're not going to get rid of evil in the world, you're not going to eliminate the state. It's like, okay, even if let's take the completely black-pilled view and say, okay, you know, we can't achieve anything. Like, we're just sort of stuck with this. Just on the intellectual side, just the acknowledgement, okay, maybe we can't get rid of this evil, but let's at least acknowledge it as evil. Like, let's have a clear enough understanding of morality. Right. Okay, like, maybe we can't get rid of this state, but can we all agree, like, it's a bad thing? Like, that's a good step one. You can't get it anywhere if you can't sit there and say, if we can't convince people, yeah, this is not something that you should have.
Right. Or it's like, it's kind of like going to God, be like, God, why did you say do not murder? Like, do you think you're going to, you know, prevent all people from all time from murdering? It's like, no, well, of course people are going to break moral commandments, but like, we still have to establish what the moral, like, what is morally normative of according to God, mm-hmm. And what the scriptures say, and using, you know, some sort of, you know, proper hermeneutic and philosophical framework to try to accomplish that. You know, that's one thing, a little bit of a tangent here. It's like, it's one thing that I really admire about the Catholic tradition is that they always seem to couple a reading of scripture with also like a sort of like, you know, Aristotelian, or I guess in the more Catholic sense, a more
scholastic or
kind of like what Thomas Aquinas did, like just this very coupling of faith and reason together. And I don't think you see that anywhere else in the Christian faith put together quite as well. And actually, the more reformed faith that I come out of sometimes has a very strong, like, you know, philosophy is bad kind of streak coming from it. And then you have like the Orthodox, which are just like, you know, well, you know, not only is philosophy weird, but like coherent sentences are also dumb. So like, it's just like, I find myself more at home a lot of times with Catholics, because it's like we're at least, I think, operating off of similar like constructed worldviews as far as like how to how to organize kind of like the different moving parts and how to tackle them. I think that the to get back to what we were saying, I guess, like, yeah, I think that, you know, anarchy is just in the same way as me saying like murder is bad. It's like, okay, you know, also theft, stealing thing is bad. And so like logical deductions that come from that, backed up, I think, by biblical observations of, you know, the stories that are documented in the Bible, both Old and New Testament. It's like, I don't think that what is normative in terms of God's moral ordained order is for humans to construct these giant apparatuses that we refer to as states or monopolistic governments or whatever, in which people have special rights that, like, you know, like for me and you, murder is bad. For these people, you know, for Hillary Clinton, it's just like a running joke how many people has she suicided. It's just like, you know,
even in a more pure conception, if you have a democracy, it's like, well, murder is okay if 51% of the population says okay, kind of thing. Like, even in that ideal, like, where, how does that make sense? Like, why does, even if your system is majoritarianism and it actually works, why is that okay? And that's the thing that I've, because I'm talking to a lot of these people and find them brilliant in a lot of cases, but I still haven't seen that explanation. So, okay, yeah, maybe there can be some kind of okay system of government, but why is this one okay? Like, all the ones that we see seem to be pretty terrible. Can you give a moral justification for any of them? And that's, and I can't find that anywhere. If people have sort of gone into detail about, you know, why a very artificial and constructed state apparatus can still be moral without it being voluntary or consensual in some way, if people have sort of gone through that analysis, I haven't found it anywhere.
Right. And I guess where the word anarchy might trigger some people, and I get it, like if we're talking about maybe like the first use of that word and the first people to call themselves that, they were definitely advocating for things and living in ways that were, you know, antithetical to Christian values. And I have no problem admitting that. But it's sort of like, I think the etymology of a word is interesting and not unimportant, but it's not like, okay, so a term developed out of this, therefore it must mean its original use for all time. Like, language can be something that develops over time. And I think people like Murray Rothbard, people like Coppa, took terms like anarchy and said, okay, well, you know, if your system doesn't work in it's not only that the left anarchy doesn't work in practice, it doesn't even work in theory. It's just like, it's almost just like angry reeing about hierarchy and, you know, property is theft, rent is theft, you know, every, you know, and it's like, okay, well, that's just like incoherent babble. But if we cut out, like, they're like, the root of what you're getting at is okay. Let's take out the incoherent babble and let's add in, like, you know, a understanding of the natural order and of hierarchy back into it. Then it's like, okay, well, now you have like an anarchy that's actually both logically consistent on paper and that we can see even coincides with the natural order that I think is both self-evident and I think that is described in the Bible. And I guess it's just like, for some people, I guess maybe they think that's like, I think some people view that as mental gymnastics. And it's like, okay, well, fair enough. Like, it's not the cleanest thing. But it's the, if I tell someone that, look, some people have said, like, well, just tell people you're a Christian or just tell people that you're a libertarian. It's like, it's just not precise enough. It's like, I want to use the most precise term. I don't like states. I don't like, you know, the initiation of force against peaceful people. It's like, I don't like, you know, and in the other sense, it's like these people who criticize this are often right wingers. And it's like, why are you ceding ground to the left? Don't let them take these terms. I mean, we have to draw a line somewhere. They've taken words already that I think, like, you know, the word liberal is completely like, it's gone. Like, I love the original Misesian classical liberal idea and definition of that, but they've completely, beat that dead horse into the pavement. Like, you know, there's just a blood stain in the pavement now. You don't even know what was there. That's how much they beat it to death. If we don't draw lines around some words and say, no, we are going to define these words and not cede that ground to the left, like, well, you know, that's just admitting defeat. I mean, and they aren't going to stop at these terms. They'll keep coming. I mean, the term Christian is under attack in many ways, in my opinion. So it's like,
it's losing in the same kind of way. Right. A little bit of pushback in a couple places. I mean, I think anarchy is originally a left word. Like you said, the original anarchists did not believe in hierarchy or rules or rulers. And it has a sort of a leftist tinge. It's like, yes, that I think the early Austrians sort of, they did the opposite of what the left's always did. They took that from the left and says, no, we're going to make this a right wing term rather effectively. Like, and it's, you know, it's, we can have that battle back and forth. But yeah, like we've been saying, like it's an easy and very precise way to sort of express something. By the textbook letter definition of anarchy, would I say I'm an anarchist? No, like I do believe in a ruler, but certainly believe in rules of a certain kind. I believe in a number of hierarchical,
right. But if you're
hierarchical structures,
right. Okay. But if anarchy means no hierarchy and no authority and no rules, it's like, well, again, that's just not even, it's not even coherent.
It's incoherent. and it's interesting reading some of the left anarchists. I went through anarchist handbooks shortly after.
You read Proudhon. I mean, it's just like,
oh yeah,
some of the most autist.
And to their credit, like they are very consistent in their completely insane, inconsistent views. But they attack everything. Like, you know, the family doesn't exist for them anymore. Like, you know, women sort of look after children. I think this is Proudhon. They're like, you know, okay, well, you know, women will sort of look after children until they can look at it themselves. But, you know, the idea of marriage or couples or fathers just sort of goes away. And they're consistent in that view. And in that sense, I don't think Rothbard and Hoppe and the like sort of took that and sort of put things on it. I think the better way to think about it is they built something from their classical liberal natural rights kind of understanding. And notice, okay, this has a lot of similarities with the left anarchist view, but the origins are completely different. Like they base it on a completely different set of principles. And then there's a not just superficial, there's some real similarity to left anarchism. And that's why they use the term, but it is completely distinct in its understanding.
Maybe a good metaphor would be like scientific discoveries over time. And like we would go back and look at Newton and go, you know, Newton got it wrong, but, you know, Newton also got some things right, and scientists come later after other scientists and pick up what they got right and refine the parts that they got wrong as we discover more over time and as we are advancing scientific knowledge and discovery. I think the same can apply to things like philosophy and certain ideas like anarchy that maybe in their infancy got some right and some wrong, but people have come after the original anarchists and gone like, okay, like we're going to take the stuff you got right and we're going to discard the things that have been borne out through, you know, both on paper and in reality experiments that show that they don't work. And we're going to refine those hypotheses until we come up with something that works.
Yeah. And so, not only that, but like you should also, and this is very true in Newtonian, in physics, the development of physics, but I think it applies here as well, is they grasp some truth that seems very clear. Like, okay, there's something clearly evil about the state. So right. if you're developing your theory, you should also conclude at some point, you know, if you're being consistent and you've got a valid theory, at some point the state should come out as being evil. Otherwise you've done something wrong. Like you can start at different points, but you know your conclusion needs to agree with observed reality. Like, okay, you know, we know totalitarian, we know communism doesn't work. If your theory goes along and comes up with communism being a great idea, something's gone wrong.
Well, so that's the weird thing about the left anarchists, is almost that like it's like the state is bad and hierarchy is like all this stuff is bad. And then it's like, okay, what are you gonna do? It's like, oh, we're gonna make the biggest freaking state we can. And it's like, wait, what? Like does not compute. And at least like, you know, the anarcho-capitalists just like, oh, they're not real anarchists. Like, well, they're the ones that actually have the end goal of abolishing the state and like, you know, achieving a workable, you know, voluntarism that's based mm-hmm. in something tangible, like, you know, Austrian economics, rather than in something like, you know, everyone will just voluntarily share and create things for the good of the people or something stupid like that. Like,
right. It's just, and then so, if we force them to do it long enough, they'll start doing it spontaneously. That's like the socialist man idea. It never really made a whole lot of sense to me. Because I don't think it actually makes any sense, period.
No, it doesn't. So, but yeah, so I think if we can, you know, push away the notion that anarchy has to be anti-hierarchy, anti-authority, anti-rules, and if it just means, you know, the more, I think, you know, the more Rothbardian idea of anarchy, then I don't see how someone can say it's incompatible with Christianity. Some of the criticisms I've heard are, you know, coming from people who are, you know, either Catholic or Orthodox, there's a few different criticisms. One of them is sort of anarchy and libertarianism, broadly speaking, is just unnecessary because you should just tell people to be Christian and that covers everything. And it's like, well, I mean, that sounds good on paper, except that empirically there are a lot of Christians who are statists and who don't understand economics. So clearly Christians are getting this wrong. So, you know, we need some sort of pushback there. But I guess the other criticism is sort of like that, one, I think it's like they confuse horizontal and vertical relationships. They're just like, well, no, God rules everything and you don't even own yourself. God owns you. And so, you know, anarchy and anarcho-capitalism and all that, like it's founded on unchristian premises because you don't own yourself. And to say that you do is to be in like rebellion against God or claiming that you are God. What do you make of that? Like my reaction is almost like that's just kind of like a semantical word game, but I also don't know if that's, you know, something that maybe there's a different Catholic perspective on that I'm not aware of.
To some degree, I think there's some semantics going on, but I think there is a distinction because I think there's a lot of very, you know, strictly speaking, libertarian arguments that according to libertarian philosophy or you know, anarcho-capitalist philosophy are very consistent, that are very un-Christian. I think the sort of the realization that I've had just in the last couple of days, just from hearing this talk, is that calling yourself a Christian anarchist, I would say, doesn't make you an anarchist. Because if we're taking this, the actual definition of the word, if anarchy is no rulers, no rules, no hierarchy, I would say a Christian anarchist. It's not just an anarchist who is Christian. There are no rules or rulers except God and his law. and that fixes a lot of those issues. With that sort of caveat, I think a lot of things sort of fall into place. And as a Catholic anarchist, to sort of be a further refinement of that, it'd be okay. No rules or rulers except God and his law and his church. And
sure. You know, yeah, the I would agree with that.
That's been given to them. And I think a lot of things come very clear with regard to the, okay, you don't own yourself thing. I think there is a bit of semantics there, because this idea that I think is true is strictly speaking, we don't own ourselves. We are, what's the word? Stewards of our body. You know, God right. owns us, and we've been given power to sort of use it to do his will. But it's his and not ours, which I think is true.
I agree. But I mean, I think it's like a functional ownership insofar as like, yes, God owns everything in a metaphysical sovereign, you know, sense as the creator, as like the being that makes reality continue being reality. You know what I mean? Like, but like in terms of like when we're analyzing interactions between men and other men, it's like, well, ownership, you know, I think simply defined as just like the exclusive right to use something. It, you know, it's like, well, you know, I, you know, in every way except that metaphysical way, I do own myself. And I think you can call that self-stewardship, but then it's like, well, what is a steward? Like, to me, it's almost like you're pushing at a distinction without much of a difference, at least in a praxis sense.
I think it's true in most cases. I think the clear exception is if you were a steward of yourself and not an owner of yourself, you can't sort of do what's in the best interest of the shareholders, as it were. Is you can't do evil to yourself, or you're morally prohibited from doing evil to yourself.
Sure.
Just as a matter of morals. And so then you get into questions, and this is one that sort of will trip up a lot of non-Christian or Catholic libertarians, and say, okay, if someone wants to kill themselves and you want to stop them, okay, you know, what's the, you know, if you're going by the purely sort of, okay, they have a right to their ownership of their body, okay, I can't stop them from doing what they want to do with themselves, that would sort of be the purely libertarian argument. I think the Christian anarchist or the Catholic anarchist would sit there and say, okay, no, they don't have that right. They don't, if something that is clearly evil they're doing to themselves, I have some kind of obligation to step in, because they're not fulfilling their duty as a steward of themselves. Now, what the extent of that is, how far that, I mean, that, because that for me is the core question, is okay, we can establish there are things that you should not be allowed to do just morally. Now, what can I as not you do about that? Because I don't think it's
right,
nothing.
Yeah.
And yeah. And filling in that area is a right. difficult one, because it's you don't want to sit there and say, like, you know, I'm going to decide what's good and bad, and if I think you're doing something bad, I can stop you. Then you can, you know, prohibition works of you know, every, if you know, if you're eating too many calories or getting too big of a Coke in New York City, I can try and stop you because I don't think it's good for you. Clearly that's not okay. Like, there's clearly some kind of line between, okay, I'm going to shoot myself in the head and no one's allowed to stop me, versus I'm going to, you know, eat too much. But where that line is, or how that gradient moves, that's something I'm really trying to figure out right now. That's where my big interest is, because I think there's a distinction in that sort of gray area there, but I don't know quite how to define it.
Right. So we have on one end people who would say, maybe like the pure ideological libertarian would say, yeah, if someone wants to do harm to themselves, that you have no right to stop them. On the other hand, and you might have Christians who go like, well, not only do they not have a right to do that, but we should construct a state and pass laws and have whatever it takes to stop people from doing this. And I guess what you're saying, and I think I kind of agree, is that like, well, both of those are unsatisfying, and there's probably, you know, maybe not, you know, exactly in the middle, but somewhere in that null space between those two extremes is probably a more reasonable approach. Or it might even be like a case by case bait. But my approach tends to be that like some of these things, there is no like universal answer to. It's almost like, you know, hypotheticals get hard to deal mm-hmm. with, because the problem with hypotheticals is you can include as many details as you want, but there's always necessarily things that are left out. And it's almost right. like you almost need those unknown details to know how to act in any given situation. And also, I think there's going to have to, I think at some point in the conversation that goes on between the different people in this ongoing dialogue, a recognition from all sides that there's no perfect answer, because the only perfect answers would the only perfect outcomes that can be made are not really in this reality. It's going to be when we are in heaven with God.
Right.
And while we live on this planet, in this reality, like, there's, and I'm not saying we should use this as an excuse to be lazy or to not push back against evil, but like, I don't know, I guess it's my praxis is not to try to achieve perfection when I know that's impossible. It's more like, I don't know, like in any given situation, it's almost kind of like, first, do no harm.
Exactly,
and then second, yeah, reduce the harm being done to the greatest extent possible. And how you do that kind of varies by the situation you're in. Like, if I saw someone standing on the edge of a bridge and it looks like they're getting ready to jump, I really have no qualms about someone doing, you know, almost anything necessary to stop that person from killing themselves. Like, I and that might even be a violation against anarchist or libertarian principles, but it's like, okay, but like, I guess this is probably where you know, I wear more of my Christian hat in this sense, because it's like, well, libertarianism is not a complete philosophy. It's a very, right, it's a very limited, and but the problem is, libertarians who aren't Christian, it's like it becomes a thick philosophy, because they have that God shaped hole in their heart, and so they have nothing to fill it with but more libertarianism,
right,
or libertinism, or something. But it's like, I do think there are instances where you are morally obligated to break property rights. Like, mm-hmm, property rights are important, but they're not like the highest supreme good. You know what I mean?
Absolutely, yeah. And I think not only is libertarianism not a complete philosophy, it's not a fundamental philosophy. Like, it's you have to get to libertarianism. And I think there's been
it's almost because a consequentialist, like a consequential, like, it's not something. I don't know if that makes sense. It's like something. It's something you conclude based upon several observations.
Yes.
It's not like something that is just self-evident or,
yeah, the NAP is not, it's not self-evidently true. It's like, but
yeah,
but I think they're sort of based on sort of the modern world we live in and how it was developed, they sort of started in the middle a little bit, and so they miss some things. Again, you have libertarian principles that you sit there and say, yeah, I would not hold to this principle. It's not a good principle. But the question is, okay, how do we make this more consistent? That's, again, this is my big project, if I could ever get around to it, and really where my interest is because there's, like we said, with sort of the left anarchism versus anarcho-capitalism, there's clearly something good there. Like, they're getting a lot of good conclusions. Anarcho-capitalism being a lot closer to a coherent and sound moral philosophy than left anarchy, but it's definitely missing something. And I think my big idea is trying to go back to, okay, how do we understand these sort of first principles of morality, and can we, from that, can we sort of refine what our libertarian principles are, so that we can handle these edge cases? Even if we, like you said, I agree completely. I don't think you try and legislate or try and give these sort of what's the Kantian term? These categorical imperatives about, in this situation you must do X, Y, or Z. I think that's, you know, I hate Kant for that for many reasons, but that's one of them. That's not fair. I don't hate the man. I hate his ideas. But I think just making sure that we have that our principles are expressed correctly and are true and are moral can be a better guide to helping in these edge cases, where clearly there's something just a little bit off about libertarian theory, because it's like you said, it's got this God-shaped hole in it. But I would love to see that sort of fleshed out better, so that we can point to, okay, here's a more coherent version of this ideology that correctly incorporates all the good that's in that philosophy, but also gets that gets these first principles, right, correct.
At the same time, because I agree with all that, I think some of like the post-libertarian types are like unsatisfied in some sense with libertarianism and anarchism, and because of that, they want to reject it wholesale. And also, then consequentially, it's like, well, forget that. Like, the focus just needs to be 100%, like, making everyone Christian, and that includes even like trying to use any means, or even some people would go as far as like any political means to force Christian norms upon people. And like I have several issues with that, but one of them is that like my sense of, you know, libertarian political philosophy, as much as we could criticize it as incomplete, would be that if we're going to have people who aren't Christian, which seems to me like a inevitability, you know, again, in this span of time from now to whatever eschatology is right, because I don't know.
we'll get you eventually. Don't worry about it.
Yeah. whatever end times scenarios end up happening at whatever point in time, it's like until we get past this part of the tapestry of God's never ending unfolding creation, it's like, okay, there's going to be people who are either temporarily or will forever reject God and reject submitting to God and his church. So, okay, one of the things we're told to do as Christians, both by Jesus himself and repeatedly in both the Old and the New Testament, is that insofar as it depends on us, we are supposed to live at peace with all people. It's like, all right, well, how do I best promote living at peace with both my Christian neighbors and my non-Christian neighbors, and even the people who I would view as my enemies in some sense? It's like, well, how do I foster the most peace? And, you know, I don't think we're supposed to be like Islam. I don't think we're supposed to try to use the sword to bring peace, which is, some people go, well, it's a religion of peace. It's like, yeah, well, the peace is kind of a euphemism in that,
yeah, the peace in that description.
peace by submission. I don't think it's what we're supposed to do. I think in some sense, it's like, even as incomplete as like libertarian or anarcho-capitalist political theory is, it's like, if we were living in a society that was 70% secular, I would rather that society be, you know, as libertarian as possible than for it to, you know, really be any other political system. Because I think that is what is most conducive to peace. And that's also like if our goal is to evangelize people, right? It's like, well, it's a lot easier to evangelize people when we're not like pointing guns at each other. So it's like, I get it. Like, it's not perfect. It's incomplete. And I agree with, there's a God-shaped hole in the middle of the libertarian philosophy. But it's like, in this imperfect world, it is the best tool we have as far as just like a strict political philosophy for promoting peace. Like, does that make sense? Or do you have any pushback there?
I don't have a lot of pushback, but I'd say even beyond, because again, I mean, the praxis I think is important, but I'm also sort of an idiot about praxis. Like, I don't know what works well. I would say it's
almost nothing.
Yeah, that's the issue.
It's almost, I love the way Jordan Peterson puts it, which he's like, most new ideas are stupid. Or like, it's just about finding the least stupid idea. Or like, he'll be right. Like, capitalism is like the worst economic system ever, except for all the others. It's like, nothing really works. It's just like, what's a complete disaster and what's a workable disaster?
One of the great things about capitalism is you can test really quickly. Like, it'll tell you, yeah, what works really quickly.
Right.
But I think beyond whether or not just libertarianism works for any given means, it just seems to me like it's the most moral that I've heard. Like, in terms of like, okay, how should I live my life? What should I do? Because I mean, not only do I think conversion by the sword is not a particularly effective way to try and, you know, run your society or your religion. I don't think it works particularly well, but I also, it's evil. Like, I mean, conversion is something that happens in the heart and is the work of the Holy Spirit. It's not something that I'm like, you know, I can give witness, I can persuade, I can, you know, badger to some extent, but it's ultimately between you and God what you're going to believe. And me trying to suppress your will in that way is, I find completely immoral. So to me, it's much more important. Okay, like we were saying earlier, first do no harm. Like, if I wanted to live a moral life, I think libertarianism gets me a lot closer to these other ideas I hear. It's okay, you've got an idea that, okay, this might work really well, but would it require me to do evil? And why should I be okay with that? Like, if your political philosophy asks me to do evil to achieve its ends, I think the metaphor that you see a lot with sort of the ring of power from Tolkien, I think that's a very good one. Like, you know, we're not supposed to wield that ring, but we might have an idea. Okay, if we were the ones in control of the state, we could do all these great things. And maybe you could, but it's going to take your soul in the end. Like, it's just by its nature, it's not for you to wield.
Yeah, exactly. And I remember someone gave me pushback on that metaphor. They were like, "Well, Aragorn still picked up the sword and went to battle and became a king." I was like, "Yeah, but like, Aragorn was like the perfect king because he didn't want it. but because of how much of a servant he was, because of the heart he had for his people, like without society put him into that position.
Right.
Like he didn't seek that position. Society put him there. He just through his own merits ended up at the top of that hierarchy and was called upon to be a servant to his people, to mankind. And so it's like, I do think there's a role for that. And I always like the Tolkien idea of like the sort of like, so he had in one of his letters, he was talking about like when he was talking about like how his political views lean towards anarchy, and he kind of thinks that like an anarchist society would almost be like, you know, years and centuries of peace. And then if conflict arises, it's almost like the Book of Judges, like the people, you know, find the king or the judge or the someone who leads them into battle and you know, does what needs to be done. And then, you know, they die away and they go back into that, like, you know,
back to the Shire.
Back to the Shire, back to the peaceful anarchy, you know, in between those stages of conflict. I guess it's just like you're not gonna, you know, we're not going to avoid conflict completely in this lifetime, but we just have to find the most harm reduction, I think. And I think we kind of see eye to eye on that one.
So. And on a similar note, like, I don't know, but I'm certainly not a pacifist by any stretch of the imagination.
No,
like, there's a place for conflict, and sometimes it is necessary to you know, we can him and Hob about the
yeah, I think we violence, can read,
but like there's a place wield, to pick up the sword. But the there's a distinction between, you know, having to defend yourself and do violence when it is just, and doing evil, and it's hard to see the action of the state as anything but evil.
Yeah. You need to be Aragorn and not Boromir, like, because, and you know, and I forget who said it. Someone was like, everyone grows up thinking that they're Aragorn, only to discover as they mature that they're actually a Boromir. Which is such a
beautiful,
such a beautiful deep state. But that story is so, like, I need to go reread and rewatch all that stuff. But I'm waiting. Like, there's such a urge when you have kids that, like, you want to show them all the stuff, but you're like, you also want to wait till they're old enough to really appreciate it. So I'm like waiting to kind of like go through, because I want to do it with like as fresh of a set of an eyes I can, to make the experience that much better. There's so much to those stories.
So I'll say this, my mother was a huge Tolkien fan. She probably read the whole trilogy and The Hobbit every other year for like most of her life, and started and so I'm some of my earliest memories, I was probably the age of some of your oldest kids, was her just like, we're gonna read The Hobbit, and then we're just gonna jump right into Fellowship of the Ring. And I had no idea what was going on. But I think your kids are plenty old to go ahead and just jump into those, because there's so much beauty in those that is worthwhile and is worth really having them experience. So I'm all in favor. Go ahead and start them young. Start them on Tolkien. They'll grow up Catholic. It'll be great.
There's so many differences between Protestants and Catholics. One of the things I've noticed, and like I appreciate, is that Catholics don't treat kids like they're stupid, whereas Protestants do. And like that is like my default mindset almost, because that's what I was raised in. But like, but at the same time, I've noticed that my kids aren't really stupid. And like sometimes, like, I'll think I have to explain things in like the most dumbed down way possible to them. And then, but then, like, my wife doesn't do that. And she's like a stay-at-home mom and homeschooling them and all that. And like, so we just recently for homeschooling had to do our state makes us do like yearly evaluations. So we had to get an evaluator to come and like check and make sure that, like, you know, we're up to the state's standards as far as like, you know. And the evaluator was just like blown away with our oldest. She was just like, I don't, like, he's like he's like, he's not even like, he's at like a third grade level, and he's like in first grade, and like and like my son like just would not stop talking about like all the things that he learned and was excited to learn and wanted to keep learning. And like, for example, he was talking about how we went to a museum, and he's really into dinosaurs. We went to a local museum that had like a dinosaur exhibit, and there were some dinosaurs there that the person that was like kind of like showing people around named incorrectly, and my son knew the name of the dinosaur just looking at the fossil and going, and it was like, no, that's, I don't even know, like, that's a Parasaurolophus. And it's like, no, and oh yeah, you're right. And I'm just like, my son's seven. Like,
why does he know more than the guide?
Right. But it's like, so, and I've started to realize, like, you know, if kids are that capable of that kind of potential with something like dinosaurs, like, there's no reason why, like, I'm coming to hate the Protestant idea, like Sunday school and keeping kids out of the service and stuff. It's just like, is that really, like, has that been good for them? Because I feel like they just get taught a dumbed, such a watered down version of the gospel through that process, that it's just like, there's no meat or compellingness or sophistication to it. And like, and then we wonder why there's so many people falling out of the faith. It's because, like, it's been diluted to the point of like nothing.
No, so I mean, man is first and foremost an intellectual creature. Is our highest power is our intellect, and we crave to know. Like, our end is to know, and so I think it's such a boon, especially at those ages. Like you said, when you're homeschooling, there's just they soak up information like a sponge. And I think it's sort of insane that we say, okay, well, you know, here's your multiplication table or your math or whatever, but you know, the things that really matter, you know, understanding your religion, understanding your faith, understanding your relationship with God, we'll give you sort of the Saturday morning cartoon version of that. Cause we're not really ready to, you're not ready for that yet. I think it does them a huge disservice. And I think it's not only are they ready for more? I think they sort of get a sense of, okay, we're not really quite getting that, you know, there's holes in this that we sort of pick up on, at least subconsciously. Right. And it sort of turns them off again, like, well, there's something more to this, but it's never really, they never get it in their formation. I think it's, unfortunately, it's an issue with, at least in the United States, a lot of Catholic formation, is there's such value to asking people to come up to a higher level, to sit there, okay, this is going to be this, you know, because for a young child it can be difficult, but they're push them to reach that level, they can achieve so much, and they are so much happier for it. And I think it's
the tyranny of low expectations, right? It's like when you tell people they're doomed to fail from the start, like, that's kind of what they're going to do.
I can't imagine a worse thing to tell a child than, like, this is going to be too hard for you. Like,
yeah,
it's, one, they hate that, as they should. And two, it sets up such a bad loop in their minds.
Well, it's like I remember arguing with an atheist years ago before my kids were old enough to really like talk yet. Like, my son was like maybe one and a half, and they were like, you know, well, you're not going to, you know, read the whole Bible to them. Like, you're not going to read the story of Abraham going to sacrifice Isaac or anything. Like, that's how could you read that to a kid? And I was just like, I don't know. Like, I remember learning that as a kid, and it wasn't, you know, it wasn't that hard for me. And I remember the first time I read that story to my son, and like, my son, like, I thought I'd have to sit there, and like, I was actually panicking at that point. I was like, oh crap, maybe this story is a little tough to read to like a 6-year-old. But he was just like, okay, so Abraham knew that God wasn't going to harm, you know, let Isaac die. And I was just like, oh yeah, you got that. It's about Abraham's faith. Okay. Like, it's not like you know, in some ways it's just like, all right, my kids, sometimes it's like, okay, my kid's really smart, or I'm just really dumb, I don't know. Like,
but, well, it's also the sort of thing, because these things can be hard, but they don't have to get it all in one blush. Like, you can give them the whole picture, they pick up some of it, you talk to them about it, and then you pick it up again in 6 months or a year or 2 years, and it's something that can build on itself. You don't have to piecemeal it to them, because there's no, like, if they don't get it all at once, that's okay. It's not the worst thing in the world.
Think about how many people out there, like kids, and like, you know, they're in like something, when they're into something, they know everything about it, right? Like, I know people who are into comics, and like, they can tell you like every obscure detail about some obscure superhero in a comic that no one's ever read. You know what I mean? And it's just like, so the key is like people are, you know, and kids and teenagers are vastly intelligent, and they can work hard. It's just like, are you incentivizing them to and raising them to put that energy and that care into, you know, godly and righteous things? And I think that's kind of our job as parents, is to like channel that energy to productive, you know, productive things and things that bring life, rather than to things that are sinful and bring death. And so I don't know how we got on this tangent, but it's something that in my constant analyzing of the landscape, because I find I'm mostly like temperamentally at home with my Catholic libertarian friends, and like, there's some people in the Protestant circles who are like sometimes irritated with me because they think that they're just like, you know, no, the Reformation was good. And I'm just like, I don't, it's like, and then they'll bring up every single, you know, reason why Catholicism is bad. And it's just like, well, it's like, again, I'm not even like, I'm not Catholic. It's just like, but you know, your argument for me being a Protestant has to be more than, ooh, Catholicism bad. I was like, that's just not, you know, like, that's just not compelling.
We're turning back into the, you know, anarchism is not a positive philosophy because it's only a negation. Like, if you're saying other things are bad, that's not putting forward any kind of positive
vision. Which is almost what Protestantism is, just meh, Catholicism bad. It's like, okay, well, build a cohesive church out of that. Oh, no, you can't. Turns out it's just endless fracturing and fracturing of fracturing. And then
I'm yesterday about the desert island where like the one Protestant has to like develop multiple personality disorder,
right? Yeah.
Just take a break off and have multiple churches.
And then, but then he'll convert to Catholicism, and then like you'll have each one of his personalities will just serve a different function. So he'll, you know, one of them will be the priest and one of them will be the bishop. God. No, it's, I don't know. One of these days, I have to have like you and Caleb and some others on to do a deeper dive into Catholicism. I'm not quite ready for it yet because I want to be prepared to like bring the certain things that like I have heard that like, if true, make it hard for me to completely like be open to exploring Catholicism closer. But I want to know if, you know, these things I was given to by, you know, people who had an obvious anti-Catholic bias. So it's like, and I mean, I've explored some of the easy ones. Like, I know that Catholics don't worship, like, you don't worship the saints when you're praying to them. And I know that some of the stuff that people say about the Catholic view on Mary is inaccurate, but then some of it I still have questions about. So I don't know. That'll have to be an episode sometime in the future.
Yeah, and I'm gonna keep pushing Caleb. I think we probably will try and get you on one of the Ostratomism things at some point and just go over whatever. But no, it's because it's the kind of thing that's there's a lot of things there, and like we were talking about at the beginning, like it's the most important thing. Like it should be sort of primary consideration. So if we're not taking our time and making sure we understand all the ins and outs of it, we're doing a disservice to ourselves. So yeah, and it can be much. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I mean, sometimes I feel like, all right, well, should I, you know, well, so I didn't abandon the Libertarian Party when it was struggling, right? Like, I joined the Mises Caucus, we took over the Libertarian Party, and, you know, we're trying to make it great again, you know, like, and it's like, some people have been like, well, if you're, you know, yeah, the Protestant church isn't perfect, but like, you know, you should just try to make it better rather than just abandoning it. And it's just like, okay, well, it's one thing to save a sinking ship. It's another thing to go to the Titanic and be like, we're going to resurrect it. I'm just like, I don't think there's anything left to save. Like, it's just, it's dead. It's at the bottom of the ocean.
I can't quite get over the irony of Protestants sitting there saying, you know, no, you don't, you know, we need to stay one unified whole. We can make this work.
Just
too late. So you had your chance.
We could have had 500 years of, like, you know, maybe the best timeline would have been that Luther and Calvin and all them had important things to say, but they just remained Catholics. And over 500 years, maybe, because not everything they said was right, but maybe like that nugget of truth that, like, we were talking about earlier, like how anarchism, like at the beginning, it was like, okay, well, you know, a lot of this is stupid and crazy, but there's a nugget of truth there. Like, if they had maybe just persevered, maybe, you know, Catholics after them would have went, you know, and I think to some extent they have. I remember listening to a podcast with Bishop Barron, and it was on Reformation Day, and he actually went through and said, look, actually, there's some things that the reformers said that were true and that we've actually since adopted. So I'm like, okay, so then, like, why didn't, I don't know.
I keep harping on it, but we've been going through Jacques Maritain's Three Reformers, where he talks in detail about Luther. And one of the sort of his sides is like, okay, these great figures in history, even if you hate everything they did, like, people that are completely worthless don't become great. Like, there must have been something good in Luther, or no one would bother listening to begin with. Like, so there had to be, like, well, I mean, one is his prose is fantastic. He's a great writer, but like, he clearly understood something. I think he got a lot of things horribly wrong, but there was definitely, you know, like you said, if he had stayed Catholic and sort of, you know, was able to refine his vision, he could have been a great priest and could have been a great, actually, you know, a reformer instead of sort of a revolutionary, like, you know, fix the things that were wrong with the church in a fundamental sense. Yeah, I think that is the best timeline, is Luther manages to find his way back to the church.
Yeah, because I mean, it's just, as much as I like decentralization when it comes to political structures and the economy and all that, it's like, I just, it doesn't work well with, like, that does not map onto Christianity and the church. Like, it just doesn't, like, ooh, we're going to have 500 different churches that all have their different interpretations. Like, wait, no, that doesn't really square well with the idea of a omnipotent creator who, you know, sent his son to die for us, and like, put your faith in it, but which one? Like, no, that just, it just doesn't work.
Yeah.
I can no longer do the mental gymnastics to try to make that work. It just doesn't.
And we have the one reality. There is a correct interpretation, you know, whether it's the, you know, Catholic one, like, or whatever, they can't all be right. So
they don't realize how they're the precursor for like this postmodern hellhole that we're living in right now, where all truth is subjective, and it's just like, you know, or as I like to say it, it's individualism gone haywire, is what it is. And people and some libertarians are like, well, you can't have tyrannical individualism. It's just like, it's exactly what postmodernism is. It's exactly what it is. It's radical tyrannical individualism. And yeah, I'm sorry, you can draw a straight line from that to the Enlightenment, and from the Enlightenment to the Reformation. So, like, I'd love to say the baby from the bathwater, but, you know, there's a lot of bathwater, and it's just a little bit of baby.
Much baby, yeah. It's just a clump of cells. No, bad joke. Okay. So the other thing I wanted to go back to is my point about, like, sort of the proper, I think, understanding of Christian anarchism or Catholic anarchism. Is it's maybe no rules or rulers except, you know, God and the law he has put down. Like, the central authority doesn't make a lot of sense unless it's the one central authority that is the King of Kings and is the source of existence. Centralization makes sense if the head of your hierarchy is I am. Like, it just, that
true.
That one will work out okay. The rest of them, you know, there's ambiguity there. None of them else have a claim of being perfectly correct and perfectly true and perfectly good. If you're under that hierarchy, you know, okay, that can work out pretty well. But any separate hierarchy, if it's not rooted in the natural law, decentralization is good because it will find the good ones. You know, the ones that work out will be the ones that sort of rise to the top. And if you try and force these unnatural hierarchies, or try and force centralization, you don't have the opportunity to discover what's good and true.
Right. And that's part of my reason why I'm so against the idea of, like, Christian theocracy too, is because, like, you can try to play the game of the ring of power and wielding the state, you know, against the non-Christians. But I think history just proves that the non-Christians and the actual Satanists and the secular people, the people who are pushing all these agendas, they are way better at playing that game than we are. Like, and that's not even a criticism of us. It's like, oh, wow, like, demonic people are better at playing demonic games than Christians.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
Like, well, duh, we shouldn't be playing those games. Like, they're not for us to play. And, like, you know, the left of, oh, God. They obfuscate everything. Like, they take words like authority and hierarchy and corrupt them. And it's like, I just always go back to, like, what did Jesus say that being a leader was? Like, it was to be a servant. It was to wash his apostles' feet. It's like, the great thing about putting God as your centralized authority, as putting him at the top of your hierarchy, is that, like, he straightens out those hierarchies and those authority structures to where they are basically libertarian, because you're not coercively ruling over people. You're ruling them in a sense, but you're ruling them through through serving them, which is the exact model that Jesus showed us. And, you know, that's what we have to try. Like, to me, that is, you know, which it, not surprisingly, you know, like Jesus is sort of like that vergence of showing how like libertarian praxis is like the mirror image of godly heavenly authority and hierarchy. Does that make sense?
I think so. And I think I hate trying to stretch the libertarian metaphor too far. And I think there's certainly a facet of that. I hate trying to, and I don't think you're doing this, but I think it can be confused to try and, you know, view the entire gospel through a libertarian lens or make it a libertarian story, which it's not.
No.
And I think there, so I think it's a valid point in
as, no, as, no, as if, any, if anything, work. If anything, libertarianism is like a Christian story, you know what I mean?
that's a better way of putting it.
Yeah. It's not that you shouldn't read, your Christianity through a libertarian lens. It's like, no, like you should read libertarianism through a Christian lens. And mm-hmm. I think libertarianism is just logical, resultant conclusions based upon the biblical Christian norms that we see in the scriptures. But I do get the pushback. Like, some people don't thread that needle, and they go to the other side where it's like, you know, oh, God can't do this because he'd be a tyrant, and or it's just like, yeah.
They have no idea what God is.
Which is funny because, like, I was always intrinsically against that from the beginning, but that's just because I'm a Calvinist, and, you know, to the Calvinist, God is a authoritarian strongman, but no. Well, we're a little bit over an hour here, but I think this was a good conversation. I think we covered some good topics. Do you have any closing thoughts or bows you want to tie up, you know, loose ends you want to tie up before we call it a night?
Yeah, I'm trying to, is there anything I can say concisely? Because it's probably been a good stopping point. There's a couple more threads I could probably pull on. We could go out for a little while longer. I do love your idea of sort of understanding the idea of the leader servant, is that that's the way that you can have these sort of natural hierarchies come into being, is you don't have authoritarian strongmen. It's like that isn't God-given authority. The God-given authority is the Father, you know, the actual father of the family, but, you know, the one that is willing to die for the people that are under his care. You know, that you actually you love your children more than you love yourself. That's the kind of person that can be an actual leader.
Right. Not See, the person the state that, yeah. makes you die for them, but true leaders die for you. Like that is sort of like, you know, partly what the gospel message, I mean, the gospel tells us so many things, but like one of those truths is that like true leadership is not, you know, go, like, cause I mean, that's what God tells him in 1 Samuel 8. He's like, you know, this, you know, you want a king, this earthly king is going to make you fight in his wars and die in his wars and serve him. But Jesus is a king that comes down and serves us. And it's like, that's such a foreign idea. Right. Like, I think
it's foreign in politics. Well, I guess that's why the analogy isn't the right word. I mean, analogy is sort of the right word, but in the backward sense, the idea of God the Father is a very poignant one, because yes, he's King of Kings, but all, like, Jesus is the King of Kings, but also there's this familiar relationship. It's a very common idea if you talk about a family, like the parents are willing to die for their children. That is the norm, as it should be. And that should be the model. And I think, like we were talking about earlier, with ownership of your body being actual self-stewardship, that's the right way to think of leadership as well. Is the people under your care, you are their steward. The highest good that you can pursue is not what they can do for you, but what you can do for them. And so the ways that you can, you know, say make them do things have to be for their good and not for yours, or it's not your authority isn't valid.
Yeah, I do think the most, like, one quick thing here at the end, like, the abortion topic has certainly made me notice, like, the most glaring hole, other than like the God-shaped hole, just broadly speaking, in libertarianism, like one glaring hole that it has that, like, I hope Christians can help to push to refine the libertarian philosophy to integrate this idea into, because it would make it more complete and more compatible with Christianity is that, you know, ownership or stewardship, whatever you want to talk about it, ownership gives you the exclusive right to control something. And that, in a sense, that's almost power, right? But like, what's that idea that, like, you know, to me, I think is actually a Christian idea, but people more famously know it from Spider-Man, like, with great power comes great responsibility. Right, and right. Like, but that's so true. Like, yes, you own, like if you want to say you own yourself or you steward yourself, whatever, like, yes, you do. You control your body. You control your property. And with
it's the parable of the talents, right?
Yeah, exactly.
It's like you were entrusted with this. You get to do what you want with it, but you have an obligation to do what you're supposed to with it.
Yeah, exactly. Like, and I think the needle that needs to be threaded there is that, like, positive rights aren't an anathema to libertarianism, but libertarianism cannot survive without positive obligations, which is, I think, distinct from rights, but to some libertarians, like, they can't see the distinction there. But I think it's like, well, I don't necessarily want to compel you to do the right thing, but if nobody does the right thing, this whole thing will not work. Like, you have to, you cannot have freedom without responsibility, and you cannot have freedom without you can't have ownership and stewardship without fulfilling the implicit and explicit obligations that come with those things.
Yeah, and ultimately, like, all the things we talk about, how we want the political system to be, if the culture is as rotten as it is, none of it does a lot of good.
Yeah, exactly.
There needs to be, we've
Rothbard got that right. He said, yes. He's like, it doesn't matter. Like, I think the way he put it was like, it doesn't matter. The politics doesn't matter to a culture that's completely, like, degenerate and fallen and doesn't care about liberty. Like, mm-hmm. You could have, you know, anarchy and it wouldn't work. Flip side, you could have, if you had like a wholly virtuous people who were anti-authoritarian and their political structure was, like, there to be abused in an authoritarian way, well, it wouldn't matter because they wouldn't have the desire to use it. So, like, I think the political structure matters, but, like, the heart of the people and the soul of the people matters. It does matter so much more.
And the political structure, I think, has done a lot to corrupt the soul of the people in the West.
That's true.
The left. Yeah. So that it can certainly work the other way in a lot of ways. But so there's something to be said for, you know, can the political structure also reform it? But we get back to
the problem. It can corrupt it, but I don't know if it's like, I think sometimes the post-libertarians, it's like, well, if it corrupted it, then we can use it to reform it. It's like,
you can't use it the same way.
Said, it doesn't, I don't think it works that way.
The mono game's better than we are. So.
Right. Exactly. Yep. Cool. All right. Well, we got to put a hard stop somewhere or we'll be like 2 o'clock in the morning and I got to go to work.
And you've got to get your 2 hours of sleep for the night. So
exactly. Right. So what again is your Twitter handle? And I don't know if you want to plug that and plug.
Sure. Yeah. So it's at Aincath, like Ayn Rand, AYNCATH. I'm writing hopefully regular. I keep saying it's gonna be more regular and it never actually happens. Anarcho-Catholic.substack.com. I'm contributing to Austrotomism. I think that's the URL now. It keeps, we're trying to get the right URL, but it should be austrotomism.com. And I'm a fairly regular, make regular appearances on the Austrotomism podcast.
Yes.
Which is on YouTube and wherever else.
And I'm there regularly in the comments trolling them because it's my new Tower Power Hour. Like I've already been on that and it's like, now it's not fun anymore. It's like I need a new podcast to troll until I can get on. So.
It's the mountain climber thing. Like I feel like you're not going the right order. Like you've done Everest, now you're going back to like we're like Kilimanjaro or something like that. But so yeah, I feel maybe. Like we need to make it a lot more difficult for you, just so you have that ambition. So until you figure out where you're going next, we're gonna have to
life's not fun without like a challenge. And it's like I climbed out Everest too soon. It's like I should have worked my way up, but it's like I just like now like I don't have anything to struggle against.
And to be fair, we're giving far too much credit to Tower Power. They're not Everest. They're like, I don't know.
No, they're not.
I'm trying to think of a moderately high hill. Like we're certainly a shorter hill, but like it's we're not above in like the death zone, right? You don't need Sherpas to get up to the top of any of these things.
No. So all right. Well, thanks everybody for watching. Thanks again, Aincath for coming on. And we will be back sometime soon with some more content. But until next time, remember, don't fear the fire.
catch those springtime vibes all over Arizona. Break out of the winter blues by hitting the water at one of our lake and river parks. Take a hike among the wildflowers. Just make sure to stay on the trails and leave the flowers for the bees. Discover Arizona's best kept secret and visit azstateparks.com/amazing to start your springtime adventure.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.